Switzerland Catastrophe. Chapter 9. Consternation in Zurich. Frightful darkness hung over Zurich during the night that followed the afflicting day of Kappel. It was 7 in the evening when the first news of the disaster arrived. Vague but alarming reports spread at first with the rapidity of lightning. It was known that a terrible blow had been inflicted, but not of what kind. Soon a few wounded men, who arrived from the field of battle, cleared up the frightful mystery. "Then," said Bullinger, whom we shall allow to speak, "there arose suddenly a loud and horrible cry of lamentation and tears, bewailing and groaning. The consternation was so much the greater because no one had expected such a disaster. 'There is not enough for a breakfast,' had said some haughty worldly men. 'With one blow we shall be masters of the 5 chalets,' had said another, and an older soldier added with disdainful sneer, 'We shall soon have scattered these 5 dunghills.' The Christian portion, convinced that Zurich was fighting in a good cause, had not doubted that victory would be on the side of truth. Thus their first stupefaction was succeeded by a violent outburst of rage. With blind fury the mob accused all their chiefs, and loaded with insults even those who had defended their country at the price of their blood. An immense crowd, agitated, pale, and bewildered, filled all the streets of the city. They met, they questioned, and replied, they questioned again, and the answer could not be heard, for the shouts of the people interrupted or drowned the voice of the speakers. The councillors who had remained in Zurich repaired in haste to the town hall. The people, who had already assembled there in crowds, looked on with threatening eyes. Accusations of treason burst from every mouth, and the patricians were pointed out to the general indignation. They must have victims. 'Before going to fight against the enemy on the frontiers,' said the mob, 'we should defend ourselves against those who are within our walls.' Sorrow and fear excited the minds of all. That savage instinct of the populace, which in great calamities leads them, like a wild beast, to thirst for blood, was violently aroused. A hand from the midst of the crowd points out the council hall, and a harsh and piercing voice exclaims, 'Let us chop off the heads of some of the men who sit in these halls, and let their blood ascend to heaven, to beg for mercy in behalf of those whom they have slain.' But this fury is nothing in comparison with that which broke out against the ministers, against Zwingli, and all those Christians who were the cause, say they, of the ruin of the country. Fortunately, the sword of the Waldstätts had withdrawn them from the rage of their fellow citizens. Nevertheless, there still remained some who could pay for the others. Leo Juda, whom Zwingli's death was about to raise to the head of religious affairs, had scarcely recovered from a serious illness. It was on him they rushed. They threatened, they pursued him. A few worthy citizens carried him off and hid in their houses. The rage of these madmen was not appeased. They continued shouting that atonement must be made for the slaughter at Kappel, by a still more frightful slaughter within the very walls of the city. But God placed a curb in the mouths of these infuriate beasts of prey, and subdued them. On a sudden, grief succeeded to rage, and sobs choked the utterance of the most furious. All those whose relatives had marched to Kappel imagined that they were among the number of the victims. Old men, women, and children went forth in the darkness by the glimmering light of torches, with haggard eyes and hurried steps, and as soon as some wounded man arrived, they questioned him with trembling voice about those whom they were seeking. Some replied, "I saw him fall close by my side. He was surrounded by so many enemies," said others, "that there was no chance of safety for him." At these words the distracted family dropped their torches, and filled the air with shrieks and groans. Anna Zwingli had heard from her house the repeated discharges of artillery. As wife and mother, she had passed in expectation many long hours of anguish, offering fervent prayers to heaven. At length the most terrible accounts, one after another, burst upon her. In the midst of those whose cries of despair re-echoed along the road to Kappel, was Oswald Myconius, who inquired with anxiety what had become of his friend. Soon he heard one of the unfortunate wretches who had escaped from the massacre, relating to those around him that Zwingli had fallen. "Zwingli is no more. Zwingli is dead." The cry was repeated. It ran through Zurich with the rapidity of lightning, and at length reached the unhappy widow. Anna fell on her knees. But the loss of her husband was not enough. God had inflicted other blows. Messengers following each other at short intervals announced to her the death of her son Gerald of Nona, of her brother the bailiff of Reinhard, of her son-in-law Antony Wurz, of John Lucci the husband of her dear sister, as well as of all her most intimate friends. This woman remained alone with her God, alone with her young children, who, as they saw her tears, wept also, and threw themselves disconsolate into their mother's arms. On a sudden the alarm bell rang. The council, distracted by the most contrary opinions, had at last resolved to summon all the citizens towards the Albis. But the sound of the tocsin re-echoing through the darkness, the lamentable stories of the wounded, and the distressful groans of bereaved families, still further increased the tumult. A numerous and disorderly troop of citizens rushed along the road to Capel. Among them was the Valaisan, Thomas Plater. Here he met with a man that had but one hand, there with others who supported their wounded and bleeding heads with both hands. Further still was a soldier whose bowels protruded from his body. In front of these unhappy creatures, peasants were walking with lighted torches, for the night was very dark. Plater wished to return, but he could not, for sentinels placed on the bridge over the Sile allowed persons to quit Zurich, but permitted no one to re-enter. On the morrow the news of the disgraceful treatment of Zwingle's corpse aroused all the anger of Zurich, and his friends, uplifting their tear-bedimmed eyes, exclaimed, "These men may fall upon his body, they may kindle their piles, and brand his innocent life, but he lives, this invincible hero lives in eternity, and leaves behind him an immortal monument of glory that no flames can destroy. God, for whose honor he has labored, even at the price of his blood, will make his memory eternal. And I," adds Leo Judah, "I, upon whom he has heaped so many blessings, will endeavor, after so many others, to defend his renown and to extol his virtues." Thus Zurich consecrated to Zwingle a funeral oration of tears and sighs, of gratitude and cries of anguish. Never was there a funeral speech more eloquent. Zurich rallied her forces. John Steiner had collected on the Albis some scattered fragments of the army for the defense of the pass. They bivouacked around their fires on the summit of the mountain, and all were in disorder. Plater, benumbed with cold, it is himself who gives us the account, had drawn off his boots to warm his feet at the watch fire. On a sudden an alarm was given, the troop was hastily drawn up, and while Plater was getting ready, a trumpeter, who had escaped from the battle, seized his halberd. Plater took it back, and stationed himself in the ranks. Before him stood the trumpeter, without hat or shoes, and armed with a long pole. Such was the army of Zurich. The chief captain Lovett rejoined the army at daybreak. Gradually the allies came up. 1,500 Grisons, under the orders of the Captain General Fry of Zurich, 1,500 Thurgovians, 600 Tockenburgers, and other auxiliaries besides, soon formed an army of 12,000 men. All, even children, ran to arms. The council gave orders that these young folks should be sent back to share in the domestic duties with the women. Another reverse ere long augmented the desolation of the reformed party. While the troops of Bern, Zurich, Ball, and Bienne, amounting to 24,000 men, were assembling at Bremgarten, the five cantons entrenched themselves at Bar, near Zug. But Zwingle was wanting to the reformed army, and he would have been the only man capable of inspiring them with courage. A gust of wind having thrown down a few fir trees in the forests where the Zurichers were encamped, and caused the death of some of their soldiers, they failed not to see in this the signal of fresh reverses. Nevertheless, Fry called loudly for battle, but the Bernese commandant Diesbach refused. Upon this the Zurich captain set off in the night of the October 23rd at the head of 4,000 men of Zurich, Schaffhausen, Ball, and St. Gall, and while the Bernese were sleeping quietly, he turned the Waldstätts, drove their outposts beyond the Sile, and took his station on the heights that overlook the Gubbel. His imprudent soldiers, believing victory to be certain, proudly waved their banners, and then sunk into a heavy sleep. The Waldstätts had observed all. On the October 24th, at 2 in the morning, by a bright moonlight, they quitted their camp in profound silence, leaving their fires burning, and wearing white shirts over their dresses that they might recognize one another in the obscurity. Their 1594 watchword was, "Mary, the Mother of God." They glided stealthily into a pine forest, near which the reformed troops were encamped. The man stationed at the advance guard of the Zurichers, having perceived the enemy, ran up to the fires to arouse their friends, but they had scarcely reached the third fire before the Waldstätts appeared, uttering a frightful shout. "Har, har, har, har! Where are these impious heretics? Har, 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 har!" The army of the cities at first made a vigorous resistance, and many of the white shirts fell covered with blood, but this did not continue long. The bravest, with the valiant Fry at their head, having bitten the dust, the rout became general, and 800 men were left on the field of battle. In the midst of these afflictions, the Bernese remained stubborn and motionless. Francis Kolb, who, notwithstanding his advanced age, had accompanied the Bernese contingent as chaplain, reproached in a sermon the negligence and cowardice of his party. "Your ancestors," said he, "would have swum across the Rhine, and you this little stream stops you. They went to battle for a word, and you, even the gospel cannot move. For us it only remains to commit our cause to God." Many voices were raised against the imprudent old man, but others took up his defense, and the captain, James May, being as indignant as the aged chaplain at the delays of his fellow citizens, drew his sword, and thrusting it into the folds of the Bernese banner, pricked the bear that was represented on it, and cried out in the presence of the whole army, "You knave, will you not show your claws?" But the bear remained motionless. The whole of the Reformation was compromised. Scarcely had Ferdinand received intelligence of the death of the arch-heretic Zwingli, and of the defeat at Kappel, than with an exclamation of joy, he forwarded these good news to his brother the Emperor Charles V, saying, "This is the first of the victories destined to restore the faith." After the defeat at the Gubel, he wrote again, saying that if the Emperor were not so near at hand, he would not hesitate, however weak he might be, to rush forward in person, sword in hand, to terminate so righteous an enterprise. "Remember," said he, "that you are the first prince in Christendom, and that you will never have a better opportunity of covering yourself with glory. Assist the cantons with your troops. The German sects will perish when they are no longer supported by heretical Switzerland." "The more I reflect," replied Charles, "the more I am pleased with your advice. The imperial dignity with which I am invested, the protection that I owe to Christendom and to public order, in a word, the safety of the House of Austria, everything appeals to me. Already about 2,000 Italian soldiers, sent by the Pope and commanded by the Genoese dell'Isola, had unfolded their 7 standards, and united near Zug with the army of the 5 cantons. Auxiliary troops, diplomatic negotiations, and even missionaries to convert the heretics, were not spared. The Bishop of Verli arrived in Switzerland in order to bring back the Lutherans to the Roman faith by means of his friends and of his money. The Roman politicians hailed the victory at Kappel as the signal of the restoration of the papal authority, not only in Switzerland, but throughout the whole of Christendom. At last this presumptuous reformation was about to be repressed. Instead of the great deliverance of which Zwingli had dreamt, the imperial eagle let loose by the papacy was about to pounce on all Europe and strangle it in its talons. The cause of liberty had perished on the Albis. But the hopes of the papists were vain. The cause of the gospel, although humbled at this moment, was destined finally to gain a glorious victory. A cloud may hide the sun for a time, but the cloud passes and the sun reappears. Jesus Christ is always the same, and the gates of hell may triumph on the battlefield, but cannot prevail against his church. Nevertheless, everything seemed advancing towards a grand catastrophe. The Tockenburgers made peace and retired. The Thurgovians followed them, and next the people of Gaster. The evangelical army was thus gradually disbanded. The severity of the season was joined to these dissensions. Continual storms of wind and rain drove the soldiers to their homes. Upon this the 5 cantons with the undisciplined bands of the Italian General Isola threw themselves on the left bank of the Lake of Zurich. The alarm bell was rung on every side. The peasants retired in crowds into the city, with their weeping wives, their frightened children, and their cattle that filled the air with sullen lowings. A report too was circulated that the enemy intended laying siege to Zurich. The country people in alarm declared that if the city refused to make terms, they would treat on their own account. The peace party prevailed in the council. Deputies were elected to negotiate. "Above all things, preserve the gospel, and then our honor, as far as may be possible." Such were their instructions. On the November 16th, the deputies from Zurich arrived in a meadow situated near the frontier, on the banks of the Saal, in which the representatives of the 5 cantons awaited them. They proceeded to the deliberations. "In the name of the most honorable, holy, and divine Trinity," began the treaty. "Firstly, we the people of Zurich bind ourselves and agree to leave our trusty and well-beloved confederates of the 5 cantons, their well-beloved Coburgers of the Valley, and all their adherents lay and ecclesiastic, in their true and indubitable Christian faith, renouncing all evil intention, wiles, and stratagems. And on our side, we of the five cantons agree to leave our confederates of Zurich and their allies in possession of their faith. At the same time, Rapperswil, Gaster, Wiesen, Bremgarten, Mellingen, and the common bailiwicks were abandoned to the five cantons. Zurich had preserved its faith, and that was all. The treaty having been read and approved of, the plenipotentiaries got off their horses, fell upon their knees, and called upon the name of God. Then the new captain general of the Zurichers, Escher, a hasty and eloquent old man, rising up, said as he turned towards the Waldstätts, "God be praised that I can again call you my well-beloved confederates." And approaching them, he shook hands successively with Golder, Hug, Troger, Richmuth, Marquardt, Zelger, and Thos, the terrible victors at Kappel. All eyes were filled with tears. Each took with trembling hand the bottle suspended at his side, and offered a draught to one of the chiefs of the opposite party. Shortly after, a similar treaty was concluded with Bern.